supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
HYY TV at 11 tomorrow morning for First, the TV news magazine dedicated to serving Delaware. In sports, Cliff Lee heads to the mound this evening as the Phils continue their series against the Pirates in Pittsburgh. Action begins at 7:05. Flyers are also in Pittsburgh. Puck drops at 4 today, and the Sixers host the Magic at 8. You're listening to WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a question that I had never heard before, but it's about a problem that's afflicting a lot of people this spring. Noisy boxwood shrubs outside their house. We're also going to have a great interview about a new book on rain gardens, how to use native plants to improve the flow of water through your landscape. That's a lot to get done. We better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Carolyn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Carolyn. How are you?
I'm great.
And where is Carolyn great?
In Winchester, Tennessee.
Winchester. What part of the state is that in?
Oh, southern middle, near the Alabama state line.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Carolyn in Winchester?
Well, when I moved here, I didn't have a compost, and so I created some temporary shallow pits to get rid of bits and pieces from the garden, from the kitchen. And now, this year, I have what appears to be peach trees growing, and I think that may be from some peach pits that I put in that pit.
And that's interesting. Now, would that have been last year's peaches?
Well, I did it two summers in that same area, so I'm not even sure what peaches they were.
But they could be 2 years old, some of these sprouts.
They're 2 feet tall and very woody and strong, and I've never seen them before.
Huh. And how many of these do you have?
8, in a very tight grouping.
And what kind of peaches were you eating? Were they local peaches?
It would be, North Georgia, South Carolina, Freestone, white peaches or something. I don't remember exactly.
Right, any kind of peach is its own reward in the summertime.
Yeah, but I wonder, should I foster the growth on one of these and see if it will produce fruit, or is it just a failed thought?
You've already got 2 years into them, so, I don't think you'd be that much further behind somebody. And you say they're 2 feet tall. My experience is peaches do grow rapidly. It's probably going to be another 3 years before you would get fruit from them if you planted them. But I believe the fruit would be good if you put the work into caring for the trees. And you can limit the size to some degree by really aggressive pruning, which you kind of have to do anyway. Peaches are one of these trees that, quote, can be topped, that you can keep reducing the size of the plant. And you're really supposed to, because peaches that are hard to reach are where disease and pest problems are going to get started.
Well, that would fit nicely in my small yard to be able to prune it back.
And how many trees do you think you can honestly have room for? They need morning sun. The more sun they get, the better. And the book says there's supposed to be 15 feet between each of them.
Ooh, I probably could only find room for one.
Well, you wouldn't want to do that.
Oh, because of pollination?
Well, the more trees you have, the better fruits are going to be on all of them. But any peach is a crapshoot until you grow it in your environment. What I would suggest if you have the room is pick the four you like the best, separate them out as carefully as you can, plant them this spring, keep them really well watered and a nice mulch of compost on them their first year after you pull their roots apart, and then as they get bigger, see which ones seem to be the healthier, see which ones seem to be naturally smaller. It'll be a while before you can sample the fruits, but I will tell you, I started with a dozen trees of very specific varieties I picked, and I have culled that down to 8 now as I see which ones do well in my environment and which ones we enjoy eating the most.
So you did say 15 feet apart?
Well, I'm not going to say that in my grove that I have behind my garden, they're probably closer to 6 feet apart. But I'm a cowboy, and they are planted too close together. I would probably split the difference with you and say 10 feet would be agreeable. But if you're really short on space, you know, I would hate for you just to, you know, you might have like 7 good ones and 1 dog, and I would hate for you to pick the dog. Do you have other places you can grow these? Anybody who can foster a peach along for you, maybe for a share of the harvest, something like that?
Well, my sister has space, but I haven't discussed it with her. We might split them up 4 and 4.
If you were to take charge of the pruning and the fruit thinning, which is the really laborious stuff, but it's all concentrated at the very beginning of the season, then I think it would be more than fair for her to take care of keeping an eye on them, spraying them with organic sprays if it's necessary, and sharing the harvest, especially if you do the heavy lifting in the beginning of the season.
Well, good advice. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, Carolyn, good luck. Get back to us in a couple of years. Tell us how the adventure progressed.
Sure.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Jim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Good to talk to you. I'm in southern New Jersey, South Seaville, inland of Sea Isle City.
Oh, okay. I know Sea Isle City. That was the first Jersey Shore resort I ever went to on my own as a young adult when I was, I think, a senior in high school. Sea Isle City with that great inlet there. What a beautiful little beach town.
Right. Well, we're inland of that, South Seaville, and I live in an old farmhouse and with a barn, and there's manure in the barn. I believe it's from horses or cattle, and it's about a foot thick, old, dry manure. And I have 2 compost, I'll call them frames. I built them out of 5/4 by 6, and I have removable slats on the front, and I alternate between them every year.
Okay.
And I would like to know if I can take some of this manure and mix it in with my compost, or is it just something I should throw away?
No. I would harvest this. How long have you lived at this property?
In 2005 we bought it, and I have believe it or not, cleared out a lot of the barn, but haven't gotten to this chore yet. It's almost like peat moss. It's compacted, you know?
You have heirloom manure.
There you go.
That's amazing. So what are you using to make your regular compost? What are the raw ingredients in your existing compost bins?
Well, I'm heeding your advice. I'm using leaf compost, and the way I collect it is my other question. I have a vacuum attachment from my garden tractor.
Right.
I mow the leaves up and mulch them up as best I can and pile them in these frames. It vacuums the yard up pretty good.
Right.
I was wondering if grass is causing a problem.
Is the grass treated with herbicides or anything?
No, we have just regular. It turns brown when the heat comes, and, you know, we just let it go.
Well, I would imagine that just your mixture of shredded leaves and grass clippings has been composting brilliantly for you.
My wife is really the gardener, and she gets all the credit for that. I'm the mechanics behind the garden.
You guys have been harvesting a good amount of finished compost, right?
Well, the compost containers just got done about 2 years ago.
Oh, I see.
So I'm still working on our methods on how to have it. Do it.
I think you're doing great. I approve of everything you're doing. And what I want you to do is begin mixing about 20% of the total volume as manure.
Oh,
so imagine how big your bins are, and then figure about 20% of that, and that can be your heirloom manure. Now, make sure you bust it up. Make sure you, if it's all clumpy and everything like that, boy, they used to have machines called soil sifters and stuff that would shake manure and dirt like that until it got all loosened up. You may have to use your noggin a little bit. Maybe spread out the leaves, toss the manure over top, and then pick it up again with your...
Till it
into the compost.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't go overboard, but don't be shy because it's well aged, and that'll move your compost along. And there are many in the organic community who believe that it really isn't compost unless there are some animal manures, some barnyard manures mixed in there. I tend to substitute coffee grounds, having been a city boy and not having any animals at my place. But yes, that manure, I don't think there's anything wrong with it, and I think it will add, especially at this age, very gentle nutrients to your finished compost.
That's great. That's what I'll do then. We'll mix it in 20% and stand back and watch the vegetables grow.
And don't be afraid to spread it out, so to speak, over the next bunch of years. Do it gradually so that you always have that 20% to mix in with your shredded leaves. So the best way to do it is in the beginning as you create the pile.
That's excellent. Sure, we'll do that.
All right, Jim?
All right, that's great, Mike. Thank you very much.
All right, good luck, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and cut more of my lettuce, cut and come again style. That warm winter many of us enjoyed moved me to start my lettuce plant super early this season, and we've been reaping salad spinners full of red, green, and gold reward as a result. But don't you go harvesting your heads just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, when boxwood makes noise, and how rain gardens can help protect groundwater and provide native plants for your pleasure. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden, made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee is a gardening resource featuring vegetables, flowers, videos, and more. The 2012 catalog is now available online at burpee.com. You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Medford Lees, a Quaker-related community for those age 55-plus and home of the Barton Arboretum, proudly supports WHYY. On April 14th at 11 a.m., it's their annual Arboretum Lecture featuring horticulturalist and author David Culp. He will share how native plants harmonize with our natural environment and help create sustainable landscapes. Light lunch and arboretum tours follow the lecture. Information about this event and details about Medford Lees' communities at medfordlees.org.
Supporting WHYY, Fidelity Investments Bucks County Investor Center, located at 1520 Main Street in the Valley Square Shopping Center. Information at 1-800-FIDELITY or fidelity.com. Fidelity Brokerage Services, member NYSE SIPC.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later, what's going on when boxwood shrubs around a house start making snap, crackle, and pop noises? We'll let you know when we get to the question of the week. We'll also have more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time for us to welcome our guest, Lynn Steiner, who is the co-author of Rain Gardens, Sustainable Landscaping for a Beautiful Yard and a Healthy World. Lynn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I don't have to tell you that rain gardens is the new buzzword in gardening. It's kind of replaced what heirlooms were 6 or 7 years ago. The world is greatly abuzz with talk of rain gardens, and I'm pleased that you have a new book out about it. But I fear that people may misunderstand. I feel that sometimes I may misrepresent what a rain garden truly is. Most of the time I talk about them, they are as a proposed solution to a yard that does not drain well. But as I go through your book, it's almost like you're advocating them just for the sheer joy of their gardenness.
Well, that certainly is a positive aspect to having rain gardens. We do advocate planting them with native plants. And so we're, in addition to retaining water, we're creating a habitat garden that welcomes insects, butterflies, birds, and that sort of thing. So it does do more than just retain water.
Well, as we go back to the early days of organic gardening, one of the first tenets after feeding your soil was inviting life into your garden. And, of course, the limiting factor in many American gardens in summertime is water. So if rain gardens really do help solve a problem of excessive wetness, they solve the second problem of lack of water for wildlife, right?
Well, yes, they do for a while, but remember that rain gardens, when properly designed, do not hold water for ideally more than 24 hours. Sometimes maybe 2 or 3 days if we have a really heavy rain, but ideally they're supposed to hold the water for less than 24 hours and then allow it to drain into the soil.
So one of the big benefits to the environment of rain gardens, and I've seen these things in all different configurations, is simply to slow down this massive torrent of water that happens after a big rainfall.
Yes, because anything that is in the water that washes down your driveway or washes off your roof through your downspouts and goes into the storm drains, anything that's in there, like fertilizer residue or pet waste or anything like that, will go directly into the water source, the river, the stream, the pond that the storm drain is entering into. And we don't want that. We want to hold the water on site, on the homeowner's property, and allow it to drain back in, soak back into the soil, replenish the aquifer there, so you're providing water to deep-rooted trees and shrubs, and keep it on site rather than have it wash away.
So this is like a corollary of the slow food movement, right? You're advocating slow gardens.
I guess that's one way to look at it, yes. Slow it down. Keep it on site.
Now, a lot of the interest in rain gardens comes from people who have drainage problems, many of whom, the vast majority of whom, will email me or call asking what they can plant that will drain their backyard. How much of a help can a rain garden be in these kinds of situations?
Well, a rain garden, here again, really isn't a garden that is holding plants that like these wet, swampy type conditions. That would be more of a bog garden or wetland garden. The plants that will do well in a rain garden are able to tolerate water around their roots for, like I said, a day or two, but then the water drains away and we actually could go a couple weeks without more rain. So then they have to be able to tolerate the drought conditions also. If they actually have a place in their yard where the water is collecting and standing like that and staying around for a long enough time that they're worried about the plant being able to survive it, they're more looking at a heavy soil that really should be improved and replaced before you would put a rain garden into that site.
So you tell me, from writing this book, from your experience working with landscapes, making them more sustainable, making them a better place for native plants, what do you see the benefits for a homeowner?
The benefits for the homeowner would be to replenish their aquifer, you know, for their deep-rooted trees and shrubs, to create a habitat garden where they are encouraging beneficial insects and providing bird food and such. More of the benefits of a rain garden come farther on down the line to the community and, in turn, to the entire world, because our water source, our water is so important, and we need to keep it clean and potable and usable. So the main reason that I like to encourage people to put in rain gardens is to think about keeping our waterways healthy.
And, you know, I don't think people understand the importance of simply slowing down the flow into our waterways. I don't think that that correlates in people's brains. They see a big chemical plant by the side of the river with rushing water coming out, and they think that has to be a problem. They know that people overusing lawn and garden chemicals and factory farming are contributing to the degradation. But probably the unseen enemy of our waterways is impervious surfaces, correct?
Exactly. In the natural world, the rain comes down, it falls on a forest, it falls on a grassland, falls on a wetland, and it stays there, and it is absorbed, and the plants use it. But we have so many impervious surfaces now with the buildup of cities that the rainwater doesn't have those places to go anymore. And even a lawn, people may think, oh, well, I've got a Kentucky bluegrass lawn, and so I'm okay, you know, but a lawn that has been mowed, compacted, walked on, the soil is worn down, compacted, is almost become somewhat impervious also. So we also ask people to add that lawn surface to the equation when they are trying to figure out how much water they need to drain into their water garden.
Right, exactly. You can kind of turn your existing lawn into a, quote, semi rain lawn by aerating it every couple of falls, loosening up the soil compaction, going to be much better for your lawn, and it's going to dramatically slow the progress of water through the lawn. You're exactly right. I just had this mental image of rain hitting a compacted lawn, and it's kind of like when you water a house plant that's been dry for a month. If you just pour a whole big glass of water into it, a glass and a half of water comes out the bottom because there's nothing to stop it. If you open that soil up, though, if you've got good soil in there that's slowing the water down and retaining it, and you slow down, you'll never see a drop come out the bottom.
Yes, that's a good analogy. That's exactly what we want to do. We want to slow it down, keep it on site. That's why a lot of cities and local municipalities are doing educational programs about the benefits of rain gardens, and a lot of them are also offering financial incentives for people to put in rain gardens. So I really would encourage your listeners to look into that and see where they might get some help, either financially or education or both.
And I think people who have seen demonstration rain gardens are used to seeing, you know, concentric circles, so to speak. You know, maybe a tiny pond or an area in the center where plants can stay submerged for longer periods of time, and then another margin of plants that can go either way, and then plants on the outside that make it look drier. But the diversity I see in your book is much greater than that.
Yes. Being a native plant enthusiast, like I am, we really put a lot of emphasis on giving readers a wide choice of plants to choose from so they can create a beautiful garden that really doesn't have to look any different than any other type of garden. A rain garden to the untrained eye should look just like any other native plant garden. So,
and the diversity of plants, your love of native plants clearly comes through, because you've got 50 pages in the back of this book of suggested plants for the rain garden, and we've got every shape, size, color, bloom time that anyone could possibly hope for. And again, I'm the plants I'm familiar with here, which is most of them, all of them are going to bring in beautiful butterflies and native pollinators, maybe even the occasional hummingbird, a lot of life in a rain garden.
Yes, we really put an emphasis on that. For every plant that we list, we give some of the wildlife that it will attract, some of the butterflies, the birds and such like that. I also want to make sure your listeners know that a rain garden doesn't just have to be perennials. It can also include shrubs and trees and ferns and ground covers, and there really is a great diversity of plants that you can use in a rain garden. So you can really have fun planning this garden.
And at the same time, because of the way you plan it before you plant it, This is a garden that's not only going to look nice to you, give you all the pleasure that we would hope for from a well-landscaped garden, but it's also going to do this unseen job of slowing down the flow of water and help keeping our waterways a little bit cleaner and a little bit healthier.
Exactly. Functional, yet beautiful.
All right. We've been talking with Lynn Steiner, who is a co-author of the brand new book called Rain Gardens, Sustainable Landscaping for a Beautiful Yard and a Healthy World. It is published by Voyager Press, and we'll put a link to it up on our website the week we air this interview. Lynn, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
And now back to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Chris, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
And where is Chris doing well?
I'm calling from Central Illinois.
Well, in Illinois, I always have to think of Chicago. How far are you from one of the greatest cities in the world?
I'm about 2.5 hours southwest.
And do you ever make the trip for fun?
All the time.
Yeah, Chicago is a great town. The home of pinball. You know, if it only had that, and it's got that in Wrigley Stadium, too. All right, what can we do for Chris in Illinois?
Well, I had ordered 10 cubic yards of compost from a garden center because we're putting in some raised beds this year.
Excellent.
My concern is that it's a mushroom compost, and it smells strange. And it has a white, powdery appearance once you get into the inside.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it is very hot, about a foot down. Now, my concern is that I heard that active compost, which I'm assuming this might still be, is bad for your garden. And I want to know if I could still use it, and do I need to mix in some topsoil to thin it out, or should I just let it sit for a while and finish what it's doing?
There's essentially two types of mushroom soil. There is fresh mushroom soil that has just come out of the mushroom house, and then there is aged mushroom soil that has simply been piled up so it can compost. The terms mushroom compost, spent mushroom soil, mushroom substrate, there's a lot of terms that are tossed around. But the material that is used to grow mushrooms is not a true compost. It really is the raw ingredients mixed together. A lot of horse manure, a lot of green sand, a lot of ground up corn cobs. And these supply the heat and the moisture that the mushrooms like. These mushroom houses are real steam baths. And the smell can be really pungent because there is a high concentration of fresh horse manure in the fresh mushroom soil. Now, you would think that it would compost while they were using it, but they get it in and out of the house so quickly. They only grow 2 or 3 runs of those white button mushrooms. And then the nutrients that fungi feed upon start to get used up, and the mushrooms get a little smaller. So they take that batch out, and they bring a new load of steaming fresh mushroom soil in. But meanwhile, the old stuff is still in a very raw state. It's still, as you noticed, very hot. And that hotness is a sign that the nitrogen in the horse manure has not really cooked off and re-entered the environment as much as would be ideal. The white streaks are not only normal, the white streaks are a good sign. The white streaks are actually a sign of actinomycetes, which are living organisms in compost that are created in a hot compost system. And they are the premier living organisms in compost that fight plant disease. I would think you still have more than a month to go before you're going to put tomatoes and peppers out, right?
Right.
So I think a month of composting, maybe 6 weeks of composting, is really going to help this material. And
okay.
You know what I would even suggest is maybe during this time you might invest in building a screen, you know, a big screen of large gauge hardware cloth that you can frame off with some wood and run the compost through. And when you make your raised beds out of what you have, maybe get some screened topsoil delivered, but look at that first, make sure you like it. And then when you're all done, begin layering an inch of this fresh mushroom soil, which will be partially aged at that point, on top of the soil. Keep it away from the stems of the plants, and don't use it until it cools down considerably. But I think you'll get some to use this season and next year, or even in the fall if you decide to extend your garden with salad greens and pansies and put in garlic and spring bulbs and all these fall-planted crops. It'll certainly be ready by then. You're going to have to use really good judgment and trust your sense of smell and touch as to when it's good to use this season. But the big answer is it's fine. It just needs to age some more.
All right.
And in the future, you just want to put a 2-inch layer of aged mushroom soil in all your beds. And this stuff will stay, man. You probably have enough to recompost the top of your beds for years to come.
Oh, all right.
All right?
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Chris.
All right. And your show is great. Thanks again for all your help.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and harvest some pansy flowers to go on top of our homegrown salads. All members of the pansy family, pansies, violas, wild violets, and Johnny Jump-Ups, are deliciously edible, and they contain enough of the nutrient rutin to prevent or reverse the visible effects of varicose and spider veins. But don't you go adding color to your salad greens while you erase the red from your legs just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what to do when boxwood makes noise. I'm Noisy Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. For over 135 years, Burpee has provided gardeners with seeds and plants for everything from tomatoes to flowers to gourmet herbs. Online at burpee.com.
55 degrees and sunny skies in Center City. It's 11:38. This is WHYY.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. You can recycle your old computer components at the 3rd Annual Delaware County Enviro Fair next Saturday, April 14th from 9 to 3 at Strathaven High School. Also next Saturday at 10 a.m., you can learn about the best magnolias for the home landscape at the Scott Arboretum of Swarthmore College. Pre-registration is required. I'll get you ready for the growing of great edibles and answer all your garden questions at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, April 24th at the Hamilton Township Free Public Library. The event is free, but you must register in advance. And the Pinelands Native Plant Sale will take place on Saturday, April 28th at the Bishop Farmstead in New Jersey. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
Later today on Fresh Air Weekend, Paul McCartney joins us. He'll be sitting at the piano to talk about discovering rock and roll, writing songs with John Lennon, and his latest work. Also, comedian Aziz Ansari, he co-stars in the NBC series Parks and Recreation as Tom Haverford, and he's got a new comedy special. Fresh Air Weekend comes your way at 1 today here on WHYY.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll answer a mysterious set of questions. People all over writing in that their boxwoods are making snap, crackle, and pop and hissing sounds. What's going on? We found out, and we'll tell them, and we'll tell you. After a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Marianne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Marianne. Where are you?
I'm in Audubon, New Jersey.
Very good. What can we do for Marianne in Audubon?
Well, I was hoping I could get some recommendations to save my lawn and my flower gardens because I have so many weeds. Weeds I've never seen the whole 33 years I've lived in this house. And I know you suggest pulling them and also maybe using a mixture of distilled vinegar and dishwashing detergent and a little bit of oil?
Nope. You're freelancing there, Marianne.
Okay.
Now, let's drop back. You've lived there for many years.
Yes.
How do you typically care for your lawn?
That was my husband's job until recently. And he used commercial fertilizers on it, which I know you don't approve,
right.
And neither do I.
Mm-hmm.
So this year, I haven't put anything commercial on the lawn.
Okay, what about cutting it?
He always did a very nice job with cutting it, keeping it high.
Okay, good.
But again, he did use fertilizers. And
well, but Marianne, I'm a little confused here. If this has only been a year, we had a very mild winter. Was the lawn fertilized last fall, for instance?
No, it wasn't.
No.
But I do notice that all my neighbors have the same type of weeds that I have plaguing my lawn, which I have never seen before.
And what do they look like?
They're long and kind of delicate looking, actually. Mm-hmm. And then at the very top, they're tiny white flowers.
Yeah, there's a lot of those around. Now, what you have to do is you simply have to torch those flower heads or do something to prevent them from going to seed, because those are like Mexican jumping bean seeds that form after the flowers fade away and the seed heads form. And then you'll be troubled by that. But at this point, I would suggest, even though it's a little late in the season and you're not going to stop crabgrass, that you still give your lawn a spring feeding of corn gluten meal.
Okay.
It is not an organic principle to just stop feeding a lawn. Lawns need some food. Now, for instance, when your husband cuts the lawn high, is he using a mulching mower or is he bagging the clippings?
He's bagging.
Yes. Yeah, see, when you do that, you remove all the nutrition from the lawn. Those clippings would have fed the lawn. So your lawn, not having been fed in the fall, having its clippings collected and taken away, your lawn is starving right now.
I see.
And that's what's really giving these weeds an entry point into your lawn. So I would say right now would be a perfect time to find a good source of corn gluten meal. You'll find it labeled as a pre-emergent herbicide and lawn food in bigger independent garden centers. Spread that on your lawn as directed, and I think the timing might be good for it to denature the seeds of this weed that is plaguing a lot of people this spring. And is it the same weed in your garden beds?
Yes.
And what do you use to keep weeds down in your garden beds normally? Do you mulch? How do you know?
Well, last year I used licorice mulch.
No, that stuff is tragic.
No. Okay.
But you at least did have a mulch covering the surface.
Yes.
But it didn't stop these weeds.
No, not completely, no.
Okay. I'd like mulching without buying into this wood trash is very difficult in our modern society. These mulches, these wood mulches, these root mulches, these bark mulches are foisted on people because it's a huge waste disposal problem. But they're not real good at preventing weeds, and they're certainly not good for your plant. So I, try to find a cocoa shell mulch, a good source of bulk compost is a mulch, shredded leaves in the fall is a mulch. But for now, I have to tell you, with this specific weed, because of the way it spreads its seeds, I would urge you, and I know this sounds crazy, to get a flame weeder. These are very inexpensive. They're only $30, $40. They use one of those little bottles of propane that you use for a camp stove.
Right.
And they have an automatic ignition. You hit the clicker, and then you just wave the flame around the top of the weed where those flowers are. And it'll destroy the flowers, it'll destroy any seeds that are forming, it'll pop any seeds that have already formed, and then, sooner or later, somebody has to soak the soil and pull these plants out, but they do pull out very easily. I would urge you to destroy the seeds with heat before you start to do that, because typically what happens around this time of year is people start pulling them and the seeds just go flying everywhere. And, of course, they're going to return to plague you next year.
Well, I have my work cut out for me.
But the way I've described it, it won't be really hard work. Just keep torching the tops till the flowers are gone and the seeds are gone. And then after a real heavy rain or after you've really saturated the flower beds, just hire some kid from the neighborhood to come in for an hour and slowly pull the dead plants out, roots and all.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thanks so much for your advice.
All right, good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Richard, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. It's Rick from Wilmington, Delaware, the chemical capital of the world. Love your show. Long-time listener, many-time caller.
Very good, very good.
In fact, I'm the first person to bring up wild hogweed on your show many years ago.
That is a truly dangerous plant. This is an alien invasive. It's very large. And unfortunately, it is so dramatic looking that people often leave it alone, and children are attracted to it because the stems are like great play swords. You play with the stems of hogweed, and you get covered with these horrible blisters. But I get a feeling you didn't call us about hogweed.
Right. I was calling to offer you a little support for something you talked about on the show 2 weeks ago. You'd mentioned that you weren't really a big fan of mulch, air quotes, made from ground-up old rubber tires.
Oh, my God, yeah. I actually experienced the stench coming off of it in August once around a public building. Mm-hmm. And there's reports from all over the country of this stuff catching fire, especially when people pile it up deeper than 3 inches. I don't know if it's the chemicals or the rubber or the moisture content, but you reach combustion.
Well, I've got something else for you to think about. You know, I'm in Wilmington, Delaware, the chemical capital of the world. Everyone I know probably works for some chemical company here. I have all sorts of relatives who work for the various chemical companies. I had an acquaintance. He was a top research chemist at one of the big chemical companies here, and he was the company's top troubleshooter and knew all sorts of stuff about chemistry, how it works, but he was also a specialist in rubber chemistry.
Ah.
He told me that there are chemicals called elastomers in rubber.
Mm-hmm.
That give the rubber its suppleness, its elasticity. Well, those elastomers react chemically with car exhaust to form chemicals called nitrosoamines. I brought this up with some TAs a few years ago when I was taking the organic chemistry lab. They didn't believe me. They suggested, you got the name wrong. It couldn't possibly be nitrosamines. Not really nitrosamines. No way. I was insistent, and they took on more of a mocking tone, and finally they told me just to shut me up that they'd check up on it for me. Well, when I came in the next lab, there was a group of them standing around, and they looked ashen-faced and apologized and said, yeah, they really do form nitrosamines. Do you have any idea how dangerous nitrosamines are? Anyway, my acquaintance told me that you should never change a car tire yourself. You shouldn't handle car tires.
Oh, without gloves, right?
Without gloves or a cloth or something. If by some chance you have to handle car tires, you want to wash your hands really well afterwards. And I just don't think it's a great idea to grind these things up and sprinkle them around
the
property.
Well, not only that, but nitrosamines would be in the family of nitrates and nitrites, compounds that are not only possible to be taken up by plants, but plants take them up readily. They search out nitrogen in every form.
Mm-hmm. That's basically all I want to talk about, is just give that sort of heads up, because every chemist I've talked to about this turns ashen-faced. Who knows what nitrosamines are?
Well, thank you, Rick. I mean, I can't imagine what would lead people to use, you know, chipped-up old car tires as mulch in their gardens.
It's because it's a way of getting people to pay for trash.
I know. And every waste disposal problem in America seems to take direct aim at home gardeners.
Yeah. Anyway, that's it. I just thought I'd take a moment to act the nosy, liberal, busybody know-it-all and scare everyone in the country.
Good, good. Scare them away from rubber mulch. You'll get a free trip to heaven.
Oh, thanks a lot, Mike.
Thank you, Rick.
Keep doing good work.
You too, sir.
I'll see you.
All right, as promised, we have a mysterious and strange question of the week for you. Noisy boxwoods? Little flying hot dogs may be to blame. Well, Alexis, we got tons of emails about this unusual problem, and we picked three of them to answer this week. Why don't you read them off for us?
Okay. Will in northern New Jersey writes, "While working outside this past weekend, I noticed a crackling or popping noise coming from my boxwoods. I inspected the plants closely, but didn't find any insect infestations or bee nests. I don't have any prior experience caring for boxwoods, but assume this crackling is out of the ordinary." And Kevin in Marshall, Virginia writes, "Help! The beautiful boxwoods my wife planted around our driveway are making a strange crackling noise. The plants seem healthy, but I'm afraid that some sort of bug is eating them." And finally, Jamie in Parkersburg, Pennsylvania writes, "Last week, the small box hedges around our house started making a fizzing sound. This is the first time we've noticed this. An online search turned up boxwood leaf miners as the cause. Yay, we're not crazy! But not much consensus as to a solution. Is it too late to do anything to save our bushes?"
Well, actually, the timing is very good, but I do have to point out that potentially discovering the cause of a noise is no proof of sanity. Seriously, when the first of these noisy boxwood emails came in, I did wonder a little bit about the sender, as I had never heard of this phenomenon. But then many others rapidly followed, several of which even identified a potential cause for me, which was a huge help. Thank you. I thought that after 25 years in this business, I had heard it all, but noisy boxwood has proved me wrong. Anyway, although the common name of this loud pest is the boxwood leaf miner, Lynn Batdorf, curator of the National Boxwood Collection at the U.S. National Arboretum in Washington, explains that the insect in question is actually a type of gall midge that stays in one spot once it settles inside a boxwood leaf. Most true leaf miners, like the ones that attack spinach and columbine, make visible little roadmap-like trails as they travel around inside the leaf. Mr. Batdorf also stressed to me that the word boxwoods does not exist. It's boxwood in both the singular and plural form. Now, although these pests actively and noisily feed for only a brief period of time, our expert explains that they can be a serious problem, sometimes doing enough damage to cause the eventual death of the plant. He adds that they only infest American boxwood and ignore the English boxwood, which contains alkaloids deadly to the insect. Yeah, this is zero help to our already noise-afflicted listeners, but it's excellent information for folks thinking about installing these highly popular evergreen shrubs in the future. Choose the more expensive English boxwood, and your shrubs will remain silent. The noisy little fiends that are currently inside infested American boxwood will soon emerge as adult flies. Most sources describe them as looking like orange mosquitoes, but Mr. Batdorf adds that they are also very distinctively shaped, quote, like little orange hot dogs, and that they tend to be pretty obvious as they hover around the boxwood, mating and getting ready to begin raising a new generation of noisy brats. In the mid-Atlantic area, this emergence typically occurs towards the end of April, beginning of May, often coinciding with the bloom of local weigelia. Destroying as many of these adults as possible can dramatically reduce the size of the next generation. So I suggested doing this with an organic insecticide like neem or spinosad, both of which are very safe for people in the environment. But Mr. Batdorf trumped me by explaining that sharp sprays of plain water can prove just as deadly to the apparently fragile little flying hot dogs. He agrees that the excessive growth caused by chemical fertilizers can attract pests like this to plants, and adds that boxwood is also often inadvertently weakened by homeowners who mistakenly acidify its soil. Boxwood thrives in a soil pH of 6.8 to 7.5, he explains. That neutral to slightly alkaline range is the exact opposite of the kind of soil that shrubs like azaleas and rhododendrons prefer. He suggests a dusting of dolomitic lime when soils are acidic, and likes my idea of a compost mulch for gentle nutrition, but adds to only use an inch of compost. The shallow roots of boxwood should not be mulched any deeper than that. He adds that hungry carnivorous birds like chickadees and wrens are often attracted to the noise that emanates from heavily infested plants when the weather warms in the spring, but that the birds can do a lot of damage to the plant as they tear apart the leaves to feast on the larvae. I was previously going to suggest attracting winged warriors to the area, but now maybe it's better to just care for the plants properly and knock the adults down as they emerge in the spring. Just don't give up on boxwood to avoid the problem. You would then be plagued by evil spirits. The Arboretum's Mr. Batdorf explains that the tradition of ringing a home with boxwood goes back to Russian cultures of the 13th century, when boxwood's poisonous alkaloids and the extreme density of its wood identified it as an excellent choice for keeping evil spirits away from a home. Well, that sure was some interesting information about noisy boxwood, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to expose me to evil spirits if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499, or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming towards our garden shore, at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check Foist to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin Love Train Griffin. Our wonderful webmaster is Rich Banowitz. His faithful internet companion is Sarah Kazar. The extremely quiet Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our noisy production assistant, Amanda No Relation McGrath, is taking pictures of spring bulbs in Holland as we speak. Our editor, Al Banks, wishes he was in Holland. He even says he'd take Holland, PA. I'm louder than an infested boxwood Mike McGrath, and I will snap, crackle, and pop back to see you next week. Think that kiwi fruit are too exotic for your landscape? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll explain how just about anyone can grow their own kiwi. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike helps us to germinate joy out of the jumble of that spring jungle. Jonquils, jasmine, Jack in the Pulpit, and more. You Bet Your Garden comes your way Saturday mornings at 11 here on WHYY. The Philadelphia